Welcome to Political Rewind. It's 3:06 on a Friday afternoon. We're coming to you live from the Midtown Atlanta studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting, sending our show out to all of you across the state of Georgia, including, we're very happy to say, all of you listening to us on WUGA out in Athens. It's a thrill to have you now participating in Political Rewind. Welcome to the show. We hope you enjoy it as much as we enjoy presenting it, and I think as much as listeners tell us they like the show too. You can join the conversation by tweeting us at PoliticsGPB. And before I go any further, I want to thank Bradley George, our Atlanta Morning Edition host, who filled in for me this past Wednesday. My family and I took a little trip up to Nashville to listen to a little country music, but I'm glad to be back in the studio to host the show today. Joining me, as he does for virtually every show, Jim Galloway, the political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Welcome, Jim.
Go Dogs.
That's right. Jim, of course, has a column in the AJC twice a week, Thursdays and Sundays. We're lucky that we get to learn a little bit about his column. That's going to be coming up on Sundays when he's here for the Friday show. Sunday, you're writing about Tim Lee, the chairman of the Cobb County Commission, right?
In a runoff with Mike Boyce.
Right, right. And maybe we'll get a little preview of that if we can later. Theron Johnson is back at the microphones, a Democratic strategist and a government relations specialist. Thank you, Theron.
Go Dogs, go Dogs.
Brian Robinson, former communications director and deputy chief of staff to Governor Nathan Deal, now out there working, doing government relations, and still working on political campaigns. In fact, I think you might be involved in this Tim Lee campaign that we are going to talk a little bit about. Yeah?
Things are going great in Cobb County these days, I'll say that.
All right.
And I will also say hello to WGA. I will be teaching on campus this fall, and I can't wait to get out there.
I love that. That's wonderful. Okay, so let's get right to it. Jim, I think a lot of people woke up this morning. I certainly did. Shocked that the Brexit vote, the vote to give Britons the opportunity to decide whether to stay in the European Union or to leave, the leave side won 52-48%, a stunning decision that's kind of sent shockwaves around the world.
Yeah, the polls were wrong again. Another surprise. It was. It's a fascinating. The numbers are coming out on the vote now, and it really is fascinating. If you were under 44 years of age, you were against the UK leaving the EU. If you were over 65, you were for it. If you didn't have a job or you were on a pension, you were very much in favor of this.
Yeah. It's and we wanted to talk about this. To some extent, we'll talk a little bit about the actual dynamics of the vote in Britain, as you started to, but also in terms of what it may predict in terms of what we're all about here as Americans move forward toward their our presidential elections here. So let's keep that in mind as we move forward on this. David Cameron, Brian Robinson, has already, he came out first thing after the vote was announced and said, going to step down as prime minister. It was Cameron who pushed this vote to appease, really, his conservative critics, the other conservative party critics who said, we got to deal with this. He thought he was putting it out there to lay it to rest once and for all. It ended up ending his career.
You can only roll the dice so many times and win. And the dice came up right for him on the Scotland vote, a year or two ago, which could have gone either way. In fact, that was a big surprise that they decided to stay by such a large margin. And his luck was up here. He was sort of in the same position as John Boehner found himself, as the head of a caucus that was hopelessly divided. And even if you won a major victory, it would be a Pyrrhic victory, because you would have made so much of your caucus angry in winning it that you wouldn't have the support within your party to continue leading. So leaders like David Cameron get countries, states through really tough times, and then they fall on a sword for the next guy because it was so divisive to get there. You know, Jim and I before the show were talking about Winston Churchill. The guy goes and wins World War II and then gets unceremoniously dumped by the British voters at the very end. And and Cameron, I think, led courageously. He led wisely. He said the right things. And at the end of the day, it sucked out all of the energy that he had to continue as prime minister.
Yeah, Theron, this would be a good time to be a political strategist working in Britain, because it's not just the Conservative Party that is now in a certain amount of turmoil. The Liberal Party is going to have to start regrouping and rethinking about what their next steps are. This is a fascinating time to be involved in politics in Britain.
Well, I think Van Jones from CNN actually released a video last night at the time where Brexit was basically becoming a reality. And he actually got a little ahead of the news media. And what he did in a very, very strategic way is that he sort of talked about what Brian just talked about, with Cameron coming in and really saying, okay, I want to respond to the people. I want to put this up for a vote. But let's dig a little deeper. The people who wanted to leave, a lot of the Conservative Party had a lot of sort of the tone that we hear in the U.S. right now, which is we want to be anti-immigrants. These were people who had very, very strong comments about racism in England and in that particular area. And these were basically people, to Jim's point, when he really broke down the demographics, these were older people who basically had felt like they had been disenfranchised. They were very angry. And the Conservative Party was promoting a lot what we're hearing in the U.S., which is a lot of hate. And so I think that Cameron and the stay group basically underestimated the power of angry voters. And I think, I got to give Van credit, and this is how he quoted it. He said that what we saw last night in London, in England, was a bunch of crazy people who had the more drive and more will to go out and vote, where you had more sane people who really actually know what the EU is, and they actually stay home.
Yeah, and what's fascinating now is you've got suddenly, even now, you can see these century old dynamics kind of start to rise up. You've got Scotland thinking about another independence vote. It may establish its own individual tie to Europe that it hasn't had since before the Battle of Culloden.
Yeah, let's point that out.
You've got Germany. Germany will be the new power of Europe, a position it hasn't had since, it had that position.
Well, a little shameless plug here, and actually Brian, because he thinks I talk some talking points sometime, he can actually see. I'm actually right now on WhatsApp with a good friend of mine. Her name is Bernadette Mills. She's actually a counselor in England, in London. And I will read it to you, and I just basically talked to her. She said, She said, "I'm so disappointed, still in a shock, really. Thanks for your kind words." But she said, "This really makes me think about what Trump could actually cause, how Trump could actually cause damage in the U.S. in November. It's the immigration issue that really hurts us in London." She said, "I'm drowning my sorrows right now in Mayfair and not far from where you are staying when I go over there."
Yeah.
So this is someone who is on the level of a city councilman. When I talked to her a month ago, she told me, Jim and Brian, she said, "No way this thing is going to pass. I mean, there's no way." And I think the correlation between what we just saw happen over there is what we possibly could see happen here in November.
And that's where I want to go with this, if I may. But I do want to pick up, Jim, on your point about Scotland. We should say that the way this vote broke down was fascinating geographically. The Leave vote all came out of England. It was the vote in England that put the Leave team over the top. Scotland and Northern Ireland voted to remain in the EU. I'm not quite sure what the implications of that are exactly. Anybody here?
Well, in Scotland, you've already got the leader of the Scottish National Party saying she's going to pursue a second independence vote.
Yeah, I was thinking about demographically. I'm not sure if 67%
67% of Scots wanted to stay in.
Yeah, so that's going to be fascinating to watch play out, whether we're going to see another attempt for Scotland to break away from the UK and really, once and for all, drive a stake in the heart of the United Kingdom. I mean, that's really mind-boggling to consider. But let's talk about it now in terms of American politics. So I don't know how many people who are listening got the opportunity that I had this morning to watch Donald Trump's visit to Scotland, which was coincidental. He was there, Brian Robinson, to break to cut the ribbon on his renovated golf course. I think it's more golf resort, I think he'd rather us say, yes?
That's right, and it's really perfect timing for him as someone who has so successfully used the campaign trail to honk Trump steaks and Trump vodka and Trump's Mar-a-Lago. This was brilliant because there's never been a better time to go to England. The pound dropped so much over the night that you can buy a lot of them for dollars. It is a great time to go to Trump's new resort. It'll be the same price for Americans as staying at a Hampton Inn in Dalton off of I-75. This is perfect.
All right. So here's why when I said real time was so fascinating. So let me set it up. MSNBC, CNN, Fox News, their cameras are all hot, live, at the landing point, the place where Trump's helicopter is going to land. There's, you know, hundreds of people gathered there. Security is surrounding him. And everyone, all the networks, certainly, the news media, waiting to hear when Trump steps off that helicopter, his first comments about this historic vote. And here's what Trump talked about.
And we've taken that building and made it something really special. Inside the lighthouse right now is incredible suites, and it's called the halfway house because this is the ninth tee, and it's called the halfway house. And on the bottom you have dining, and golfers will stop and they'll go and get something to eat, and then they go into the 10th hole, 10th tee right next door. So the lighthouse, and it was in disrepair, and all of the people from Landmark Scotland and all of the people that we had to go through were, I just thank you, because it was a long, difficult process getting that approved, but they really wanted to see it.
He has beautiful, incredible suites in the historic lighthouse.
For 20 minutes, he walked you through every darned hole on the course.
Now, I'm someone, guys, who loves to play golf, and I'll be honest with you. When I listened to his comments, for the first few seconds, I was envisioning this halfway house that he was talking about. Because, you know, most golfers, when you get to the turn, you're either trying to improve your game or you're just trying to finish strong.
Or have enough drinks so that finishing strong won't matter.
Enough drink. But see, this is what I've been saying for over a year now. At a time where our president, President Obama, if you really look at what he said yesterday, which was, I thought, was very, very important. He acknowledged that, listen, this was a very, very bad incident that occurred, a bad vote, a bad, you know, result for our country and the world. But he really talked about how the UK is a strong ally of the US and how we have been depending on them to help us in many, many situations, and they've been depending on us. And he really conveyed a sense of, you know, we're not going to let our brothers and sisters in the UK and in these places really suffer. But Donald Trump, this is the guy that folks just voted for to be their Republican nominee, and he's not going to change.
Brian,
I just think it's important to note that this may be the first time that we can bridge the differences between President Obama and the Republican nominee. President Obama has spent as many days on the golf course as he has in the Oval Office. This is a perfect pairing for the two of them. Maybe they can go play golf together.
But the difference is that Bill Clinton, even I would give a little credit to George W. Bush, will not use that opportunity as you fly over into your new elaborate golf course in your helicopter and fail to basically acknowledge what happened, but to Jim's point, spend 20 minutes talking about basically promoting your businesses. And this is what Donald Trump has been doing the whole time.
You two, Jim, here we have two political consultants, guys who are considered really good at their game. And if I were you guys, I would, you know, who is sitting next to Trump on the plane, Jim, saying to him,
they've won the vote to leave.
When you get off that plane, you have this incredible opportunity to make a statement that will get worldwide headlines immediately. And he talked about the golf course. Now, we're going to play in a minute some comments he made that were really strong about the exit. But
they were all mixed in with his business. You know, people asked him, what about the economic, the pound dropping through the floor? And he says, well, yeah, that means more people can come see my golf course.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
this president is privatizing the political process here.
but to your point, Bill, is this. Trump has no one telling him. I mean, let's not, you know, for our listeners, he fired his campaign manager, which, you know, the spin was, well, it's not uncommon to kind of change leadership, you know, once you're done with the primary and you go into the general. No, I think this is a classic example. And I think Bakari Sellers, I always like to give people credit. He said it best on CNN. What Trump had did for a year, and I think he's doing it now, but it's not as effective. It's like he used that dog whistle. And when he sort of blows into that dog whistle, when all the dogs get in formation or get in line, he uses this very hatred and divisiveness rhetoric to basically, you know, get his people very motivated to vote for him. But at the same time, I think his campaign staff, I mean, he's had 2 to 3 senior level people leave because they can't take it anymore. So to your point, Bill, I think that Donald Trump is going to continue to this same, you know, this rodeo that he puts on through the primary. And I think he thinks he's going
to
work in the general.
I think he has to do that because that's his brand. And I don't think that he can have a advisor like Theron or me in his ear saying, you're going to get asked this, and here's the talking points that you need to use. Because if you do that, his brand begins to fall away. It is not the package that people have come to expect and that his most fierce defenders and loyalists believe in. And he risks losing that loyal base if he does change. He becomes something that's more straight-laced and typical normal politicians sticking to talking points and giving policy speeches that are actually meaningful and serious.
You know, it was interesting. Before he landed in Scotland, he was picking up a whole lot of criticism, Trump was, for the trip, because he had nothing on the agenda that was anything that smacked of foreign affairs. And one of his advisors told a reporter, I think it was in the New York Times, he says, look, Trump is going to Scotland. Your political elites... We'll talk about him not going to see David Cameron and all those folks, but your ground troops, they'll see Trump in Scotland.
Yeah, maybe it's for the best, because if you remember, a very scripted normal politician named Mitt Romney as the Republican nominee went to England in 2012 as the nominee, met with David Cameron, and ended up insulting all Britons by saying they weren't going to do a good job on the Olympics.
All right, so I want to be fair to the Trump listeners out there, I do want to play some of what some people would say are the substantive remarks that Trump made about the vote. Here is an example of what he had to say about it.
I was actually very surprised that President Obama would have come over here. He would have been so bold as to tell the people over here what to do. And I think that a lot of people don't like him, and a lot of people voted. I think if he had not said it, I think your result might have been different. But when he said it, people were not happy about it, and I thought it was totally inappropriate. And when I said what I said, I told people, I said, don't do what I'm saying necessarily. Do whatever you think, but this was just my opinion. He came in and really tried to convince people to stay. And I thought it was inappropriate. And then she doubled down and she did the same thing. And obviously, for the 219th time, they were wrong. They're always wrong. And that's the problem with them.
So, of course, she, meaning Hillary Clinton, Trump, on his previous visit to Scotland, we will recall, said he supported the leave side of this thing. He thinks the Brits will do better as an independent nation.
Yeah, and I think we need to get into a little more of the substance of what he said. I watched that same clip after you pointed it out to me. I found it on YouTube and waded through the golf portion. But after the golf portion, this was all about immigration. It was about very little except for immigration.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things you have to remember. The difference between the UK and the US is Britain's electorate is 90% white. They are only recently, only post-World War II, are they coming to grips with a multicultural future. Whereas in the U.S., we are, I think, white population. You folks will tell me if I'm wrong. Is it two-thirds white in the U.S. electorate?
Right.
Right. And we have already
down from the high 80s when Reagan was president.
Right. But we have had a civil war, and we've had a civil rights movement to make its imprint on this country as far as multicultural, its multicultural direction.
And, you know, and Jim, you just actually. And I've talked about this a lot on this show, and Brian, he hates when I talk about this, but he actually acknowledges that it's actually factual. If you look at
he hates you, but he loves
yeah, he does.
You.
We have a hate love relationship. But it's all about the electoral map for Trump and Hillary. And to your point, Jim, is this: listen, I'll be the first to give Donald Trump credit that he ran a very unconventional campaign on a Republican primary and did something that no one at this table thought he could do. But the challenge is what Jim just laid out. You can go and say those things. And by the way, he needs to really do his research. I mean, President Obama is fairly, you know, pretty popular in London and across the world. But the thing that I think that Trump is failing to realize is while the immigration issue is something that keeps me up at night, that I think that he is in a masterful way really struck a nerve with a lot of his base supporters. I think when you start talking the way that he's talking in a country like the U.S., it does nothing but alienate independent voters, which of whom are mostly women, which of whom are actually people who don't necessarily identify themselves with a particular party. And I think that if you look at these states where Hillary Clinton is leading right now, like in Florida, that's the trouble that Trump is facing.
So let me Hillary Clinton did not make an on-camera statement, at least as of the time we were producing the elements for the show. And I'm not sure she has yet, but she did say this. Our first task has to be to make sure that the economic uncertainty created by these events does not hurt working families here in America. We also have to make clear America's steadfast commitment to the special relationship with Britain and the transatlantic alliance with Europe. A vast difference between the way Mrs. Clinton and Mr. Trump handled this.
Right, right. She tacitly, she didn't use the word, but she tacitly acknowledged nuclear weapons are at stake here.
Yeah. So let's, before we move on, by the way, the president made very similar kinds of remarks, saying Britain is our closest ally and neighbor, and we will do everything to maintain that relationship. But let's really take on, and you really kind of have talked around it, but let's address it directly. And Brian, I'll start with you, if I may. There is certainly a global movement, if not global, certainly in Western nations, including the United States, there is a nativist movement. There's an anti-immigrant, xenophobic to some extent, movement afoot among the working people of the these countries, for want of a better word. We think Brexit could now spread to France, to Denmark. There, the right-wing parties in Europe, which have been ascendant but then stymied, may be back on track. So the big question becomes, what does this vote in Britain say about what we might see unfold on Election Day in the United States?
I think seeing this pushback in European countries, most specifically today Britain, shows that this democratic talking point that all of these working class white people in the United States are somehow racist and more racist than anybody else. And the truth is, every culture, every civilization in world history has resisted cultural change in rapid fashion. And that's what's happened in our country. We've had unregulated open borders for years now. And it's changed the country much faster than people are comfortable.
I want to reset the question because I think you make an excellent point. Whether, you know, Theron Johnson, a Democrat, clearly puts that in the context of hatred. Even if you were to strip away from it those value judgments, there is a nativist movement afoot. By the way, Theron, Ted Barfield, who is a real follower of ours, is tweeting a lot about you. He said on Twitter a few minutes ago, so all of the Leave voters are old racist white guys, nice here with Democrats, really think of their political opponents, which is, in a way, what Brian is saying. But I guess the real question is whether you want to characterize it objectively or with, language that's more colorful. Is there a nativist movement that we're going to see unfold in the right race and that could surprise a lot of people who think there's no way Trump can be president?
Well, number one, I think you've already seen it at work, and it's always been in the U.S. But again, I mean, I'll take issue with one thing that Brian said is that American cultural history has always been about absorbing the newcomer and accepting him and actually adopting a whole lot of what that newcomer has brought to the table, whether that newcomer is Hispanic or African or of African origin. I mean, they absorb it and they assimilate
over time.
Over time. Now.
In each one of those groups, though, even the ones who look like the English white people who showed up here in the 1700s, you know, when the Germans came over, when the French came over, when the Italians came over.
There was a period of adjustment.
There was a period of adjustment and discrimination against those people. The Irish, who are as closely genetically probably to the Brits as anyone, were horribly discriminated against when they first got here. You know, no Irish need apply signs in the windows. And, you know, I think assimilation, adopting, you're absolutely right. I mean, you look at the food that we have and the language we use that comes from African culture, from the slave trade, the food.
Well, I hope not from the slave trade, but
that's how the people got here.
But let me jump in here. See, I think that the point that Brian, which he I got to give him credit, he definitely is doing his best to make a logical, statement about what happened, but more importantly, what his, you know, Republican nominee has basically been doing over in the U.S. And I totally agree with Jim. And I know we're going to get into this later about what John Lewis and others did with the sit-in. To me, it wasn't so much about what the individual John Lewis did, but it was just to buy racial, the coalition of Democrats really coming together.
Let me interrupt because we are going to get to them because I want to finish this segment before we go to a break with another Trump aspect of this. All right. So today I think it's arguable, Theron, whether this is a good day for Trump or not. He's in Great Britain on the day of the vote. He's boasting about the fact that he predicted it correctly. He says, well, gee, other people can say that it's because of me they did this. I can't. But he's sort of taking credit for it. But I think he's also, the question becomes, if he's staking his future to some extent, what happens in the months ahead in Britain, having said this was a good thing, if the pound continues in free fall, if jobs don't start coming back, there are so many elements here that we've already heard sound from people in England who are saying, gee, we cast our vote as a protest vote. We didn't really expect it would win.
Right.
So I'm thinking, this is a risk for Trump. Things may not go so well over there in terms of the vote in the immediate aftermath in the months ahead.
What Trump was doing is what a lot of people talked about a year ago when we really didn't think the guy really wanted to be president. We just thought that he was doing this because he just was a little mad at the country and really wanted to put some issues on the forefront. I think what you saw today was that he was basically creating himself a safety net, which is that if he continues to run this race, and I think he will lose in November, is that he's saying, you know what, why not come and, you know, spend your money at my golf course? Look at me. I'm building this world-class golf course that even though you can't really afford, but because of the value of the pound and everything. So when you ask me, do I think it was a good day for Donald Trump? I think it's actually, I'm 50-50 on it, Bill, I'll be honest with you, because I think it'll be a good day for his supporters. I mean, he'll be able to probably raise a little bit of money and get a little bit of his folks fired up. But the other side is, the 50%, is that he continues to basically drive a wedge between him and the American people, especially the independents.
All right, thank you. Here's what I'd like to do.
But I think the Brexit vote is good for him because it does show that a lot of what he is saying is not out of left field, that is held not only by a lot of Americans, but by a lot of Europeans who feel the exact same way. Their country is changing too fast for what they're comfortable with.
All right. Here's what I'd like to do. We're way late on getting a break in. I'd love to do that. When we come back, Theron already set the table for this. We should talk about this extraordinary sit-in in the U.S. House led by Atlanta Representative John Lewis. We're going to bring in Jim Galloway's colleague, the AJC Washington correspondent, Tamar Hollerman, to give us her thoughts on this. But then, Brian, after we do that, because that's the other big political story of the week for Georgians, I think, then I want to come back to you. You had a unique position to watch how trade happens between the governors, as in your role in the governor's office, with a country like Great Britain. So we're going to talk about John Lewis, but then later, people should stick with us because I want to hear your take on the economic implications of this vote for the state of Georgia. So you're listening to Political Rewind. You can tweet us at PoliticsGPB. It's 3:36. Right back in a minute.
The countdown has begun. GPB's fiscal year ends in just a few short days on June 30th. Your contribution now at gpb.org will help us wrap up this year on strong financial footing so we can continue to serve you with the programs you rely on and enjoy. Show your love for GPB and make a difference now. That's gpb.org and click donate. And thank you.
You're listening to Political Rewind on Georgia Public Broadcasting and 18-station radio network. Good afternoon. GPB Atlanta is licensed to Georgia State University, collaborating with universities in China, Korea, Turkey, Brazil, and South Africa.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. We're live in the Midtown Atlanta studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting. Brian Robinson, Republican consultant. Theron Johnson, Democratic consultant. Jim Galloway, the political writer. I always like to say the lead political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
The chief.
You frown at me when I say that because...
I think I'm just the oldest.
The chief.
Well, that's what I meant. I know it's hard to imagine that we aren't not taking up the victory for Led Zeppelin this week, being exonerated of charges that they plagiarized Stairway to Heaven, but the Brexit vote killed that part of our conversation. Jim, we're going to get tomorrow. Hollerman, your Washington reporter up on the Hill, on the phone in a sec. But tell us what happened with John Lewis this week.
Well, it was what, Tuesday? Tuesday we had John Lewis stood up to give a speech. He was kind of ticked off that the House had done nothing on gun issues. Although, you know, this is the day after the Senate actually had a debate on four bills. None of them passed, of course. And he decided right then and there he was going to sit down. Now, it had been well planned in advance, and I think they settled on John Lewis as the natural leader because of his history.
A remarkable what? I mean, I don't remember. I was out up in Nashville listening to music. Went on for
26 hours on
okay.
Periscope.
Well, that was the other remarkable thing, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But first, let's welcome Tamara. Are you on the phone with us?
Yes, I am.
Well, welcome to Political Rewind. It's really wonderful to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Just give us, if you wouldn't mind, you were up there, I assume you were in the House gallery or running around outside the chamber reporting this story. What was the atmosphere like? What did it feel like to you?
Sure. Well, let me start off by saying this was something that was totally unexpected. It was a really well-kept secret by the dozen or so Democrats who had planned this out. And so this happened in this period on Capitol Hill. It happens every morning. Members can go up and talk about whatever subject that they want. So normally people aren't really paying attention all that closely. But all of a sudden, John Lewis gets up there. He calls up about two dozen of his House colleagues. They stand around him. And all of a sudden, they sit down on the carpet. Nobody knew what to make of it. Nobody had seen anything like this in a really long time. So the buzz started building, and everybody just coalesced on the, you know, ran to the House chamber to see what was going on. And before you knew it, the media section of the House chamber, which is usually pretty empty because we can watch on C-SPAN, everybody was in the chamber monitoring it because the cameras had been cut.
Yeah, I mean, we should point that out. It is the House leadership, in this case, certainly the Republicans under Speaker Paul Ryan, who have control, yes, of whether those cameras are on or not. Am I correct in saying that?
Yes, sir. That is something that's determined at the beginning of every Congress as part of the House rules.
Right.
So you could hear Paul Ryan saying, well, guys, you know, you approved this when we did our House rules earlier in the year.
So, in fact, there went the C-SPAN camera, but that didn't stop this from becoming a viral phenomenon. It's the first time we have seen that kind of use of cell phones on the floor of the U.S. House, and even C-SPAN, Jim Galloway, was taking feeds from cell phones.
Oh, right, from the Periscope and Facebook chat. It was... And I'll tell you what, the shaky cameras made it kind of more fun to watch. Yep. You thought you were really looking at something that you weren't supposed to.
Tamar, did you get a chance to talk to John Lewis about this? And although we've heard some of this, and we're going to hear a more official pronouncement about this from him, what this to me was such a powerful echo of the John Lewis of the Civil Rights Day, whether you agree with his position on gun control or not, to see him back sitting in, to hear them singing, "We Shall Overcome." What was Lewis's mood like?
He seemed very overcome with emotion and excited to be a part of this movement yet again in a new way on the House floor. And talking with some of those initial more junior rank and file Democrats who kind of started this idea, we need to do something bold. They mentioned being inspired by what John Lewis did in the 60s with some of his lunch counter sit-ins, and that really inspired it. They brought it up with him, and he was immediately on board, and that's when the effort really started gaining steam.
So let me introduce you, if I may, to our friend Brian Robinson, who is listening to you and I here talk about John Lewis reliving the Civil Rights days, and he, I think, is eager to jump in. Brian?
I want to echo what Speaker Ryan said. This was a shameless publicity stunt. And I think, almost immediately, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee was trying to fundraise off of this publicity stunt. And to have John Lewis, who is an American hero, I'll be the first to say, an American hero, a legend, who led on civil rights, to use that legacy for a political stunt just diminishes his distinguished history and reputation.
All right, so let me jump in here, and let me be fair, because I like to be fair and sometimes balanced. The Republicans did the same exact thing in 2008, where, now let me be fair, Speaker Pelosi, they turned the lights off. They basically turned the radio, the mics, that no one could basically film it. And they protested. Now, it wasn't in the, you know, in the very nonviolent way of John Lewis in a sit-in. But I think the problem that I just totally disagree with Brian is, at that time in 2008, you had the GOP sending out fundraising emails and basically using that protest around the energy bill. It did the same exact thing. Now, to defend Congressman Lewis, because he doesn't need me to defend him, but His office, his campaign, has never sent out a fundraising email, and the email that went out from their office was an email encouraging people to sign the pledge. But I think the biggest thing here, and I'll be very quick, the problem is this. The Republicans were going to basically have an agenda, and Tamar knows this, that was not going to take up a gun bill, and the Democrats got wind of that. Speaker Ryan was going to basically finish the session that day, and they were all going to go home until July 5th for their July 4th break. And so I think what was so amazing about this wasn't just John Lewis. I mean, you also had other members of Congress who have been working on these bills for a very long time and basically saying we need to do something about gun violence in our country. But what they did is that they forced the Republicans' hands. And it was also Republicans. It was two Republican bills that we could have voted on that day. Not we, but the congressmen and congresswomen could have voted on that day, but they refused to pick it up. So I think John Lewis should be totally commended. I mean, he is our congressman here in Atlanta. I am so proud of him and what he's doing, and I think it was so relevant, and it was for the 49 people who lost their lives in Orlando.
Hey, Tamar, are you still on the line here?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, question for you. Okay, so John Lewis was the leader, and I believe Hank Johnson was involved. Were any other Georgia Democrats involved? Did David Scott show up? Did Sanford Bishops show up?
Now, I heard that David Scott was there. He joined a little bit later after a committee meeting. Sanford Bishop was not. Now, he is one of the few remaining Blue Dog Democrats on Capitol Hill, this small group of moderate Democrats whose ranks have been shrinking in recent years. And he is in favor of gun rights, and he has gotten quite a few donations from the NRA in recent years. So that explains why he was not there.
Yeah, and he, of course, has a district that he's been done a remarkable job getting reelected and reelected to, because that is more and more Republicans down there, and he wins.
Yeah, but one of the things I also want to say on this show, because my good friend Brian Robinson, my brother to the right, you know, he tweeted out earlier today that I wanted to take people's guns away, right?
Yes.
That's what it is. That's what he said. Throughout this entire peaceful sit-in tomorrow, and I know you can back me up here, throughout this entire peaceful sit-in to basically do something about the gun violence that has been fueled by hatred in our country, no one ever mentioned, nor did I and no member of Congress mention, taking away a person's Second Amendment rights. I want to make sure that that is clear. Democrats are not saying take away your Second Amendment rights. Right.
Tomorrow, let me ask you, because you've been really generous with your time up there, let me, before we engage Brian again in this, let me ask you, because it's relevant to what Theron just said. The Speaker shut this down. They went off on their 4th of July recess with no action, no bill introduced that would in some ways deal with people on the watch list, on the terrorist watch list, being denied guns. John Lewis, in his remarks, said we're coming back right after the holiday and we'll start this all over again. What are we likely to see when the holiday ends?
We don't exactly know yet. Nancy Pelosi, right before she left, mentioned they are not going to stop until they see a vote on a bill on the floor. But we don't know what they're going to be doing in terms of tactics. Some Democrats have said, no, we're going to do the sit-in again. Others have kind of kept their cards closer to the vest, including John Lewis. So we really don't know. Where a lot of the action will continue is in the Senate. They're still in next week, and there's a chance that they could vote on more gun proposals. But the House, it's an open question.
One more question, Tamar. Was there, during this whole 26-hour episode, was there any serious consideration by Ryan's office to bring in the sergeants at arm and haul these people
clear
away?
Clear the floor.
My understanding is that there was not. It was within his power as Speaker to do that. But in terms, you know, the Democrats were very successful in drawing all of this outside attention, drawing in more interest to what they were doing. Had Speaker Ryan done that, it would have just drawn more attention to it, which is not what Speaker Ryan wanted.
All right. Listen, we've got to get a break in tomorrow. It's really wonderful to have you on the show for the first time. I hope you'll come back and join us again at some point. We love hearing from you up in Washington. So thank you so much for taking time to be with us today.
Anytime.
Okay. We do have to get a break in. It's 3:48. Very quickly, people are sending us comments on the Twitter. Laura Salas, very nice comment. So thankful you're on the air makes this Friday commute through the city to the airport a little more bearable. She likes all of you guys, obviously. Khalid says, can we expect President Trump to handle the Middle East from his Trump Dubai resort, which he will bill the State Department for using? And
yeah,
Janet Burns says, why do gun activists always leave out the well-regulated part of the Second Amendment? Ted Barfield, again, thinks that what Trump said at the golf resort is exactly what you say at a ribbon cutting like that, and we should give him a break. Okay, we got to get a break in ourselves. It's 3:49 almost right now. You're listening to Political Rewind.
You count on GPB to bring you reporting that helps you better understand our world. As GPB's fiscal year comes to a close, we're counting on you. Listeners make the commercial-free, independent journalism you hear on GPB possible. While you're thinking about it, please show your love for GPB and make a contribution in any amount. Go to gpb.org and click donate before June 30th. And thanks.
A lot has happened this week.
Brexit.
Maybe the most corrupt person
personally,
ever.
Because he has no answers.
And it's a win in our fight to restore the separation of powers.
We'll unpack it all with our Friday regulars, EJ Dionne and David Brooks, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut, Brian Robinson, Theron Johnson, Jim Galloway in the studio live with us. today. Brian, did you want to, I didn't give you a chance. Theron was very unhappy about your tweet that he was trying to take away the guns of Americans.
No, he wasn't. See,
quick response?
This is a tactic that Theron uses. Here's what it does. I make a joke on air, and then he responds real serious to the joke. And then all of these women text him and go, "That Brian guy's so mean to you. You're a sweetheart. We love you." There.
Brian, thank you so much. Thank you so much for bringing us into your process.
Women,
that's what happened.
Women, women run the world, man.
It's a ploy.
All right. I promised that we would spend the last few minutes of the show because I think it's really important. We can talk about the global view of what this Brexit vote means, what it means to American presidential politics. But let's get down to the nitty-gritty. Brian Robinson, tell us about what it means to the state of Georgia. We don't, understanding that we have no idea what will happen, but there are things that could happen.
A strong British economy is good for Georgia, and here's why. Of the countries that we export to as a state, UK is the fourth. They take the fourth most goods from us. In 2015, it was $1.8 billion in exports to the UK. And we know that trade jobs pay higher than comparable jobs that don't involve trade. So that's a lot of money in Georgians' pockets. Also, we are a hub for the UK here in the country. The Consul General has an office here for the Southeast. And in 2011, my old boss, Governor Deal, met with the trade representative of the UK and established a trade office here. And in more recent times, we've had the Pinewood Studios open in Fayetteville. That is a British company where they make James Bond and Harry Potter films. Here they're making Marvel and Disney films, amongst other things. Down the coast, we have JCB, which is a heavy equipment operator. In fact, there are more than 200 UK companies in this state. 49 of them are in heavy manufacturing, which are, you know, high-paid jobs. So this is directly an impact onto Georgia. Now, that's why I say a strong economy in the UK is good for Georgia. A bad economy or a sinking economy isn't devastating for us on the other side. But there's a lot of potential for upside when things are going well there because they have invested a lot of money in our state.
Theron, you want to jump in?
Well, I think, and Brian just did a great job of really, making this sort of, localizing this tragedy, what just happened, over in Britain. But I think the thing is that what Trump is doing with his rhetoric now puts people like Governor Deal and our two U.S. senators and all the other states that are beneficiaries of having this working relationship with Britain, particularly in the U.K., because you have a guy who's running for president, who is the leader of your party, who is basically doesn't help you back home in a message that basically allows him, allows those people to operate. And then I think also as we get closer and closer, you're going to start to see more and more Republicans distance themselves from Trump because they're worried about some of these very down ballot races in a lot of these battleground states.
So there are also these economic ties that, as you say, Brian laid out so clearly. We're really not quite sure what might happen with all this. If the pound continues to fall. I mean, right now, the pound, I think, as of a little while ago, was trading. It was almost 1-to-1, which is crazy. I mean, we haven't seen the dollar have so much value against the pound in decades, right, Jim Galloway?
Right. And that's not necessarily good for business.
Right.
And that's my point. So, I think that, Governor Deal will probably want, because it's just what you do. If you're a governor, or if you're a senator, or even a mayor, and you have a good working relationship with a foreign country to basically help grow your economy, you usually want to come out and say, hey, I really want to push back on what just happened. But unfortunately, in this political climate, I think that that's something that we're not going to see a lot from Republicans.
And this is what makes Republicans very, very nervous about Trump,
right?
Is that when he's talking about renegotiating trade deal because we've been cheated all these years, and that it's not fair, and that we want a better and larger slice of the pie. That doesn't go well when you're talking about trade relations.
And I guarantee you this, all the PACs and definitely the Hillary Clinton campaign, you're going to see that footage from today or, yesterday or I guess today of him on that helicopter in that expensive golf course. You're going to see that footage, that visual played out in a very, I think, attack ad on Trump as we get closer to November.
All right. Well, we're going to watch all that unfold. I don't think we can leave this show today without pointing out there's some big news that broke this week on Hillary Clinton. And I think Theron Johnson, if you're not aware, I mean, this the your Political Insider reported on it, among others. An Associated Press review of the official calendar that Hillary Clinton kept as Secretary of State identified at least 75 meetings with longtime political donors, loyalists, Clinton Foundation contributors, and corporate and other outside interests that were not recorded or were listed without the names of those she met. And AP says the missing entries raise new questions about Clinton, how Clinton and her inner circle handled government records documenting her State Department tenure. So we've spent a lot of time today, Brian Robinson, talking about the problems that Donald Trump may have. This is the the drip, drip, drip on Hillary Clinton has got to make many Democrats wish Joe Biden had not decided not to get into this race.
When I clear my calendar, it means one thing. When she clears her calendar, it means something else.
I think there's a long-running history of a lack of transparency, a effort to obfuscate at every turn. The belief that she is above the rules seems to be a thematic that runs throughout her behavior. There is no way the Secretary of State, who has been in government, who is the most insider of insiders, the most elite of the elites, doesn't know you can't have a server in your house for the State Department. So the problem that Hillary Clinton has is Americans don't trust her, and even Democrats don't trust her.
Yeah, I think we may see video of the Trump helicopter landing at his plush golf resort, but we're going to see Hillary Clinton. Boy, there's a lot of ammunition the Trump people can
throw. I trust Hillary Clinton, Brian, so I'm one of those Democrats that do. But I think this, listen, you know, this race is a long way to go, and Brian knows I've called on Donald Trump and many others. If you want to talk about full transparency, this is a guy who, you know, refuses to release not only this past year's tax returns, but he won't even release his tax returns for the last 2 to 3 to 4 years. And so I would just tell people, you know, if we're going to talk about transparency, let's fully talk about it. And I think that once Trump, you know, releases his tax returns, which I hope he will, I think it'll show that he's basically been a beneficiary of some of the tax problems that we have in our country.
Jim, right, you got a little less than a minute to finish this.
One thing that I would point about that Associated Press report that gets to Hillary Clinton's motivation. There was an email that surfaced to her confidant in which she said she wanted to make absolutely sure that the personal never became public, and that is, I think, that's a legacy from the 1990s, yeah, and the Bill Clinton troubles of that day.
All right, everybody says it over and over again. We have never seen two candidates for president with the high negatives that both of these people bring in, and it is going to make, we all know, for one of the nastiest general election campaigns, certainly in modern presidential history. So that's why we're here at Political Rewind every Wednesday at 2 and Friday at 3 to cut through the garbage and get at the truth. Today we had Brian Robinson, Theron Johnson, and Jim Galloway, as always, doing that with us. I'm Bill Nigut. As we leave you today, let me say, some of you out there know the name Sid Mashburn. GQ Magazine says that his Atlanta menswear store is the finest men's store in the country. If you listen to Two Way Street tomorrow, you will hear the story of why, and also hear a conversation with just one of the most interesting guys in Metro Atlanta. That's tomorrow at 4 and a Sunday morning at 11. I'm Bill Nigut. We're at Politics GPB. Keep the conversation going on Twitter. See you again next Wednesday at 2 o'clock.